Okay, good afternoon, everyone, or all of those of you who are here. We seem to be losing more and more people every day. So we'll have to think of something to do about that. Can't be their comparative advantage not to be here. So anyway, this slide you've actually seen before, because this is the first two problem sets in the first exam by discussion section. So here's the next two problem sets, as well as exam number two. So if you compare these, again, a couple of things that kind of pop out. One is the problem set scores were on average a little bit higher, so I need to write harder problem sets. And the exam scores were significantly lower this go around than the first exam. But also notice that at least for exam number two, that the dispersion amongst both between the mean, which is a first number, and the median, which is a second number, they're all very close. And the differences across discussion sections is not all that wide either, actually closer than what we had on exam number one. It is disappointing, of course, that the scores are that low, but it's also true that the standard deviations were bigger, so there were big moves to the high side around the mean and median, and also scores, unfortunately, that were well to the low side of that. This last column is the weighted average for the first four problem sets and both of the first two exams. So now a couple of things. This came up, I think, last time. The problem sets, if you had a zero on a problem set because you didn't turn it in, it's not included in the mean and medians, but it is included in the weighted average. So again, their weighted average is not just a simple weighted average of those means and medians. Once again, you'll notice that we're fairly close across discussion sections, and the means and medians are very fairly close, which is what we like to see, what I like to see about consistency of grading across discussion sections as well as dispersions. Now, remember that you get to drop one of your problem sets, so it may be one of these, so things will be a little bit different. Also, keep in mind that final course grades are determined by GSI sections, so you don't have to worry about if you're in ASRAT section with a 72 mean or a Liang section at 74, that's not going to make any difference between discussion sections, because I assign letter grades by the discussion sections by GSIs. Needless to say, the further above the weighted average mean and medians you are, the better your grade's going to be. You had a question? Yes, they're all out of 100. I convert everything to a percentage. So the problem sets that only had 50 points were still just calculated as a percentage. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Is the weighted average for these three grades, or is it all
four problem sets and two exams? So again, that may not be the problem sets that we're going to actually use at the end, because we only use the top five. Yes?
It's
stuck in my computer somewhere, but I don't know what it was. It was, I want to say 12, 14, something like that. In that 12, 15. I'll try and remember to look that up and let you know on Tuesday. No, that's exactly the question he asked. What was the standard deviation? And I don't remember off the top of my head. So obviously it varies between discussion sections. But now that you've reminded me, I'll be sure to look that up and either send you out an email or we'll talk about it on Tuesday. Yes. Right. Well, I'm looking at these scores, not this score, right? So I don't assign letter grades to the individual ones. I'm just assigning points over here. So what I'm going to be interested in at the end of the semester is the weighted average of your five highest problem sets and all three of your exams in whatever that is. So this is the column that I'm interested in and you should be interested in. You can calculate your weighted average and figure out where you are relative to that. Okay? Yes? I don't know. I don't know. So weighted averages have, the weighted average median, the second number, historically has been around a B. Okay. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Okay, today we want to start a discussion that will actually last for the next couple of lectures about international trade agreements. And we want to start today just by talking about why we have international trade agreements, what the advantage is. A very quick and brief history of international trade agreements in the 20th century, early 21st century, and then a discussion about what we refer to as preferential trading agreements. And one of the things that we'll see is that most trade agreements up until about the last 20 years now have actually been what we call multilateral agreements. And since the last 20 years, most of them have actually been preferential trading agreements. So we need to understand both the multilaterals as well as the preferential trading agreements. So remember that we've been talking about things like tariffs and import quotas and export subsidies and all these other types of trade policy instruments that governments put into place typically to protect an import competing industry or to support an export-oriented industry. And we can see that even though there are net losses in terms of national economic welfare by imposing those, there are benefits to the producing companies, regardless of whether you're an import competing firm or you're an exporter. And we talked earlier about how those who are receiving benefits from trade policy are typically much more politically organized and influential to try to secure those benefits and to sustain those benefits over time than are the losers who are typically the consumers of the products. So whenever two countries come together to try to remove trade barriers, and they enter into an agreement. Now, we've already seen that when you remove a trade barrier, you actually have an increase in national economic welfare. So when we come together to do that, we refer to that as an international trade agreement. When many countries are involved, then it's a multinational or multilateral trade agreement. All trade negotiations under the World Trade Organization's auspices are multilateral trade agreements. So they include all members of the WTO, which now exceeds something like 150 countries. So let's just take a situation about why we might want to think about having formal negotiations here. So let's take two large countries. And the emphasis here is on large, right? So these are going to be large countries. And we'll just assume for the sake of simplicity of this discussion that these two countries are symmetrical. That is, remember when we talked about symmetry earlier, that they have exactly the same effect on one another. We'll have the U.S. as the import country and China as the export country. And what we'll say then is, let's suppose for the moment that the U.S. puts on a tariff. And again, because the U.S. is a large country, it will also drive down the world price, which of course is China's export price. And if we were to calculate the welfare effects, we would want to look at area A, B, C, D, and E. Okay, so those would be the welfare effects that we would see on the U.S. Now, if we thought about the change, though, that is occurring here, that tariff means that consumer surplus will go down by A, B, C, and D. Producers are better off, of course, and very well organized. And the government will receive tariff revenue of C plus E. So when we think about our net change, we end up with our production and consumption distortions and this little bit called E, which is positive, which is our terms of trade gain, our terms of trade gain. Now the question then becomes, is it possible for the terms of trade gain to be larger than the production and consumption distortions? And the answer to that question is yes, under certain circumstances. And the circumstances have to do with how big is the tariff. So notice that if we have no tariff at all, there are no terms of trade effect. If we have, and there's also no tariff revenue. If we have a prohibitive tariff, there will be a terms of trade effect, but there won't be any tariff revenue. So the terms of trade effect, actually, that E area disappears, right? So a prohibitive tariff is going to drop imports to absolutely zero. So as we raise the tariff rate as a large country and push down the world price, this area E here goes from zero before the tariff is imposed, and then it starts to get larger and larger before it starts to get smaller and smaller. So there's a point at which, if we could pick it right, where we would have the maximum terms of trade effect. And at that particular point, it can generally be shown, not universally, but generally be shown that that terms of trade effect is greater than the consumption and production distortions. So what that means then is it's possible for this to have a positive value. And the tariff rate that generates that is sometimes referred to as the optimal tariff. Now it turns out that that optimal tariff will actually be fairly small. Remember, the larger and larger the tariff is, the bigger and bigger the production and consumption distortions will be. So you want to keep those production and consumption distortions as small as you can relative to the size of your terms of trade gain. Okay. So now let's look at this from China's perspective. We could also look at the various areas that we have here. We're going to have more areas. Okay, so I want to label all those little areas in there. And now we can calculate the net change, consumer surplus, producer surplus, government revenue. And what we see for China is that consumers are better off by area A plus B, but Chinese producers are worse off by A, B, C, D, E. China did not impose a tariff, so there's no tariff revenue. So China's welfare clearly declines by C, D, and E. Again, we've got production and consumption distortions, and in this case, a terms of trade loss. So China is unambiguously worse off. The U.S. could be better off. Now, let's think about a trade game. Yes? Sure.
Is the term of trade loss the D area?
I'm sorry,
the D area? Is that the term of trade loss?
Yes, yes. The terms of trade loss is D, right? So here's their exports, and that's what's happened to the price. Yes? No, it's the lower price they receive for their product on the world market. So they're exporting at a lower price. The tariff will be, in some sense you can say yes, it's the part of the tariff that they end up paying because they will be getting a lower price for their product. But it's not a tax directly on the Chinese producers. The tax is being placed on American importers or consumers. It's just that part of that tax, remember, a tariff is just a tax, part of that tax is passed forward onto consumers of the product in the U.S., and part of that tax is being passed backwards onto producers in China.
Mm-hmm.
Well, remember, in the U.S.'s case, the importer's bringing it in at the lower world price. So the importer, the U.S. importer, is buying it from China at a lower price. So the Chinese producers are worse off because of that. Now, the U.S. importer brings it in at the low world price, sells it at the tariff-ridden price. But the difference between those is the size of the tariff. And that's the money that goes to the government. Okay? So let's think about a trade game. Very similar to what we did with strategic trade theory, what we want to look at is where is the Nash equilibrium? What's the optimal choice for both the U.S. and for China? So we're going to have either a tariff or no tariff. And the tariff that we're going to talk about is going to be that optimal tariff. So remember, in an optimal tariff, the terms of trade gain is bigger than the consumption and production distortions. So let's think about the U.S. Situation. If there is no tariff, there's no welfare gain in either country. Oops. If the U.S. imposes the optimal tariff, notice that they end up with a small gain. Where the terms of trade are offsetting the production and consumption distortions. China, by not having a tariff, is actually going to have a large loss. They have both production and consumption distortions as well as the terms of trade loss. Okay. Now remember, we said that for simplicity of analysis, these two countries are symmetrical. So if this is the outcome, if the U.S. has an optimal tariff and China has none, then we just flip it if China has the optimal tariff and the U.S. has none. So in that case, China would have a small gain. And the U.S. would have a large loss. Now, what happens if both countries put on a tariff? Now, they'll be on different goods, right? So from the U.S. perspective, if we put on a tariff, then at least in the context of that product, we have a small gain, right? It's the same thing that we have up here. So we get a small gain there. But what happens if China puts on a tariff on a different product that they import from us? They also get a small gain. Again, just looking at it from a partial equilibrium analysis. So what's the optimal position for the U.S.? So for the U.S., it's clearly we want to have a tariff. Whether China has a tariff or not, we end up with a small gain. What's the optimal outcome for China? The optimal outcome for China is to have a tariff. Because regardless of whether the U.S. has a tariff or not, they end up with a small gain in that product. But we're looking at, what we're doing though is, this is why I say it's a partial equilibrium analysis. We're looking at the aspects of the particular industry that we're putting the tariff on, right? So when we put a tariff on imports from China, as the U.S., we get a small gain out of that. China gets a loss. There's no doubt about that. When China puts a tariff on, they get a gain from that. Yes, they impose a loss on us, but that's their action. Our action is still, we want the gain from our tariff. Right? No? Confused? Okay. So let me, yes. Okay, let me come back to that. That's exactly the point. Free international trade is not the best outcome for both countries.
So I think like how I want to kind of design is like if we impose a tariff, then we're assuming that the other country will also be having like a tariff similar trade war, so they're saying there will be like less economic outcome.
That's right. That's why I say it's a partial equilibrium analysis. If I don't take into consideration the response of the other party, then it's always in a country's best interest to impose, a large country's best interest to impose a tariff, right? So if I'm only thinking about one industry, I can put on a tariff or not put on a tariff. If I put on an optimal tariff, I get a net increase in economic welfare. That's all I'm looking at is that one particular industry. That's what I should be doing. Every large country would have exactly the same opportunity, the opportunity to improve their welfare, economic welfare in that industry by looking at an by imposing an optimal tariff. Now, does that mean that you can't have retaliation by the other party? And the answer is, no, it doesn't. But if you look at it from an individual, and remember, trade barriers are by individual products or individual industries. I think I mentioned that the only country that I know that has a uniform tariff was Chile. So everybody, we've got so many damn tariffs on different kinds of products in different industries, that's got to be the way people are looking at it. So we've got our tariffs, they've got their tariffs. Why do we put them on? It must be because we think that we're better off, or at least the political process has been perverted in a way that each country thinks they're better off with those tariffs. So if we think about it from a partial equilibrium perspective, this is what we actually ends up happening. Now notice that these large losses that are taking place here, we are taking into consideration what the other country is doing. But that's all looking at it from a single industry effect. Here we've got two industries going on. Now we know, and we can show what happens, if both countries actually do this, both countries end up with also having net losses, right, on the good that they are exporting. Right? Okay. So what we actually end up with then is a situation where, because policy is done on a partial equilibrium basis, this ends up being our Nash equilibrium, and we find that trade protection is very easy to justify as a way of improving a country's national economic welfare. So if that's the case, now what we need to do is to figure out, how do we overcome that? What we have seen, by the way, is exactly what was suggested, that free international trade does give us the highest level of national economic welfare. But when you have play policy games, it can be shown that that is not necessarily the outcome that will occur. So how do multilateral negotiations actually help out here? We have talked earlier that import competing producers are generally very well organized and can be very well politically connected and will lobby for some sort of trade protection. Consumers of a product which receive most of the benefits from imports are generally widely diffused, find it very difficult to organize either financially or politically, and therefore do not provide very effective opposition to trade barriers. So another way of trying to offset the power of import competing producers is to pull domestic exporters into the picture. Now, domestic exporters are not going to be able to do or say much about what's going to happen in the import competing industries. But if we're opening up additional trade possibilities in other countries, exporters stand to gain. So by lowering trade barriers, we hurt well-organized, perhaps well-politically connected import competing industries. But as a counterweight to that, we've now brought in domestic exporters who are all also financially concentrated and probably also reasonably politically connected. So it's the exporters that we need as a counterweight to the import competing industries, not trying to organize the consumers. Okay, so with that just as a thought, let's just think about trade agreements in general. Now, trade agreements have been in place for gazillions of years. I mean, literally gazillions. First trade agreement in recorded history goes back to something like 3500 BCE, so 5,500 years ago. So, but what we're interested in is what's happened somewhat more recently. The big collapse, the first big collapse in world trade happened during the 1930s in the aftermath of the United States adopting the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. This increased tariff rates quite dramatically in the United States. It did not cause the Great Depression. It couldn't, since the Great Depression actually started before Smoot-Hawley was passed. However, it did cause a significant shrinkage in international trade. And that presumably aggravated the Great Depression. We know that trade volumes in the United States went down sharply, both exports as well as imports. Now, the reason behind the Smoot-Hawley Act was we were in the Depression. Unemployment rates were rising very quickly. The idea was if we could keep out imports, we'd have to make it ourselves. And that means we put a lot more people back to work. Well, that would make sense if you could sustain the exports that you had. But it turns out our major trading partners, Canada being the first, said, whoa, time out. If you're going to put import our tariffs on our imports from Canada, we're going to put tariffs on imports from the United States. So Canada raised tariff rates. England raised tariff rates. France, Germany. And we've had a global ratcheting up of tariff rates and a big collapse of international trade. When Roosevelt was elected in 1932, they recognized the bad deal that was there, and they started with a series of bilateral tariff negotiations, primarily with Canada and the UK. And so we sent trade representatives to both those countries to talk about this. This was slow going because we don't have uniform tariffs. So every negotiation had to be across a wide range of products in a wide range of industries. Some progress was made in this, and tariff rates between Canada and the United States and the UK and the United States started to come down in the late 1930s. The whole process, of course, was interrupted by World War II. So after World War II, a decision was made that rather than do bilateral, let's see if we can't do some multilateral trade negotiations. Let's bring together a group of countries. It turned out to be 23 countries, European, Canada, basically Europe, Canada, and the United States. And they set up an agreement known as the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is referred to as the GATT. And these were basically the trade rules, the organization that, excuse me, I shouldn't say that. It was not an organization. It was a treaty. So it was an agreement that the signatories to this agreement agreed to abide by the provisions that were in here. And the GATT basically had two ways of trying to bring down tariff rates. The first was it had levers, which were ways of pushing down the tariff rates, and it also had ratchets, which were an attempt to keep rates from climbing again. So the ratchet part is pretty easy to understand. It simply said, within the negotiations themselves, as we brought tariff rates down, we would also bind them. This process of binding created a ceiling for the tariff rate. So if you were underneath your bound rate, you could raise it, but you could not raise it above the bound rate. For the initial set of countries, their tariff rates were their bound rates, so that there was no possibility of backsliding for them. So again, a bound rate is simply one in which tariff rates could not rise above that level in the future. There were also, of course, all sorts of non-tariff barriers, things like import quotas, voluntary export restraints, export subsidies, and there was an attempt to try to eliminate these as well. For import quotas in particular, the attempt was convert the import quota to a tariff, right? Find the equivalent tariff rate, And then we could use our levers and binding to negotiate those rates down as well. There were also agreements, no new import quotas. Hasn't always been so strictly enforced. Export subsidies were talked a lot about, but not much was done. The lever for pushing rates down were groups of negotiations that were typically referred to as trade rounds. And there have been a whole bunch of trade rounds that have gone on. The first five were parallel bilateral negotiations, which only meant that each country negotiated with every other country individually, but at the same time. It was really kind of messy. It required a much larger conference room than actually getting everybody in the same room. But it actually worked pretty well. Tariff rates were pretty high at the end of World War II, so bringing them down was something that was not all that difficult to accomplish. It was also the case that there were actually relatively few countries involved. Remember, GATT was set up, the original signatories numbered 23. The sixth round was what was known as the Kennedy Round, initiated by President Kennedy, completed in 1967, and gave us a 50% reduction in tariff rates of most of the major industrial countries. There were very few emerging markets involved in GATT in these early rounds. The second round was the Tokyo Round, completed 12 years later. In fact, the Tokyo Round began within a year of the Kennedy Round being completed. So they kicked it off right away. And again, the whole idea was to reduce tariffs. And in this case, they were also trying to deal with non-tariff barriers as well. The eighth round was the Uruguay Round, completed in 94, and had really two major areas that it looked at. How do we liberalize trade? And can we have some administrative changes that would expand the areas in which trade negotiations could deal with? So on the liberalization side, more tariff rate reductions, about 40%. Now remember, we've been reducing tariff rates through seven previous rounds of negotiations. The Kennedy Round in itself cut those tariff rates in half. So yes, the Uruguay Round reduced rates another 40%. But rates in most of the industrialized countries were very low to begin with. So another 40% of a very low rate really isn't that big a change in tariff rates themselves. There were also some significant movements in two areas that had been very stubborn to get agreements on, agriculture and clothing. Now, it actually turned out clothing, they made huge progress subsequently. And in agriculture, the progress is still faltering. So not much that was gone on there. There were also new rules about government procurement, most of which have not been followed. But government procurement just says that governments need to open up the markets where they buy goods and services for imported goods as well as domestically produced goods. So the most important thing probably is the transformation of the GATT into the World Trade Organization. So remember, the GATT was the general agreement. It was simply a treaty that you could sign on to or not sign on to. There was no formal organizational structure, although there was a secretariat and a staff and people who worked there. They all moved over to the WTO in 1995. So the WTO is indeed a full-fledged international organization. But the GATT only talked about goods, trade barriers on goods, where the WTO was expanded to include both services and intellectual property rights. The big part of the WTO, or probably the most effective part, from a trade perspective, is the dispute settlement process. GATT was started in 1947 or 1948 and ran to 1995. There were trade disputes that were being appealed under the GATT system for over 25 years without resolution. So this became a major problem. One country would accuse another country of some sort of illegal or non-agreement trade policy, and they would take it to the GATT for resolution. And it would be fought out by the lawyers forever and ever. And the average settlement period was 7 years. Under the WTO, the dispute settlement process is targeted to be completed in 12 months. So that a panel of experts is put together, trade experts and industry experts, is generally brought together very quickly to hear the case, render a preliminary ruling, generally within 6 months, allowing for appeals from the aggrieved parties, and then a final resolution inside of 12 months. It's actually worked quite well. With very few exceptions, most trade disputes get settled very, very quickly. Now, of course, remember that the WTO does not have a police force. It does not have an army. So it actually has very limited enforcement rights. So it is in the WTO's purview to tell a country that they're breaking the rules of the international trade agreements that the country has voluntarily agreed to when they join the WTO. But if they decide not to change their behavior, there's not a great deal the WTO can do to force a change in behavior. It does, however, allow the harmed country to take legal trade policy actions in response to that. So if a country has been ruled to illegally be subsidizing its exports, the importing country, and doesn't change its behavior, the importing country will be granted a waiver to apply tariffs against that subsidized product. If a country is found to be dumping illegally under the WTO rules, and does not change its behavior, then the importing country will be granted a waiver to apply a tariff against those dumped products. Now, I said countries, but remember, it's actually business firms who are engaged in the international trade, but the enforcement has to be done by the country, the business's government. Okay. Well, like we've said before, most of the costs to the Uruguay round were very highly concentrated in very well-organized groups, and the benefits were widely diffused, producer surplus, consumer surplus. So, of course, there's been a great deal of fear reaction to what the WTO or the Uruguay round actually accomplished. The annual benefits were expected to be about $200 billion when it was fully implemented. It's been more than fully implemented by now. The benefits, as best we can measure those, actually seem to be about twice as large as the $200 billion that was actually suggested. Given the protests that were taking place, it was actually somewhat surprising to many observers that anything passed. The authors would suggest that one of the reasons that it passed anyway was fear of a protectionist backlash if it failed. That concept was actually quite popular up until about 3 years ago. And 3 years ago, what we saw was basically the collapse of the next round of trade negotiations, the ninth round, which is called the Doha round, which has basically collapsed and failed. And, of course, this has also happened during a rise of protectionist sentiment, not just in the United States, but pretty much around the world. So I'm not sure that this fear of the consequences of not passing something really make much of a difference. Now, one of the things that all of the WTO, and for that matter, GATT agreements require is that all trade agreements must be non-discriminatory amongst the parties involved. So what that means is that within a trade negotiations, countries are given what is known as most favored nation status. So if the U.S. decides it is going to lower its tariff rates on imports from Canada, which, by the way, is Canada is actually not a good example. Let me pick another example. If the U.S. is going to lower its tariff rates on imports from Brazil, a member of the WTO, it must also reduce tariffs on the same products from any other country who is a member of the WTO. Every member of the WTO is given most favored nation status because they are members of the WTO. So you have to, when you change your tariff rates, have this non-discriminatory policy. There is, however, one huge exception to that. And that is countries can establish what are known as preferential trading agreements. Essentially, what this says is the U.S. and Brazil could enter into a preferential trading agreement and have different tariff rates between themselves than all the other members of the WTO if and only if the tariff rate on imports between Brazil and the United States is zero. That is, if we create a free trade area, then we do not have to apply that zero tariff rate to all the other members of the WTO. So it's just generally a bilateral, but sometimes multiple countries can be involved in creating these free trade areas where you get rid of all your trade. Generally, you're negotiating to get rid of all your trade barriers, but tariff rates in particular. So there's been a big push over the last 20 or 25 years for free trade areas to be established. One of the reasons for that is as the WTO has gotten larger and larger, we're up to 150 some odd countries now, to successfully conclude a trade agreement requires unanimity. Everybody has to agree. If there's a single holdout, no matter how big or how small the country is, the agreement will not pass. You'll notice that a lot of those trade agreements took a decade or longer to actually get done, in part because everybody gets a say and a vote in whether or not it's going to take place. Bilateral negotiations are obviously much easier because there are only two parties involved. So free trade areas can be, or preferential trade agreements can end up looking like two different areas. A free trade area is one. So the North America Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, is a free trade area. Within a free trade area, there are not supposed to be any trade barriers or tariff rates between the imports and exports of the members of the free trade area. Each member, however, can have its own tariff rates against outside members. So for Canada, the United States, and Mexico, the tariff barriers between them were negotiated to go away over a very long period of time. They're mostly completely gone between U.S. and Canada and rapidly being phased out between Mexico and the United States and Canada. But each of those three countries can have very different tariff rates against China or Brazil or other countries that are not members of the free trade agreement. The second type of free trade area is what is known as a customs union. So the European Union is a customs union. Within the context of a customs union, all the countries agree to have the same tariffs against outside members or outside non-members. I guess they wouldn't be members, right? So outside countries would have all face the same tariff rate for every member of the customs union. So if you want to export a product to Europe, what you'll find is the tariff rate that is applied by Germany is exactly the same tariff rate that's applied by France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and all the other members. So we've got a uniform tariff rate against outside countries, no tariff rates on the inside. So that's a slight difference between the two. Administratively and politically, these two are also quite different. Free trade areas are pretty straightforward to negotiate. Generally, two countries, they just got to get together, make an arrangement, and do it. They're incredibly complex to actually administer. And one of the reasons for that is foreign exporters actually try to arbitrage different tariff rates. So if Mexico, for instance, has a much lower tariff rate on some item than the U.S., foreign exporters will want to send it to Mexico. But the product may actually be destined to be in the United States. So it needs then to be transshipped from Mexico into the United States. But there are no tariffs between Mexico and the United States. However, there are tariffs on imports into the free trade area that get applied for the United States. So if you go to the U.S.-Mexican border, you'll still see lots of border agents, customs agents, because everything that comes into the United States from Mexico, we have to find out, was it made in Mexico or was it made in Brazil or China or Chile or Australia? Where was it made? And then we got to figure out what tariff rate to apply to it. So administratively, it becomes very complex. It becomes even more complex if the product was imported into Mexico and then used as part of as a component into a semi-finished or finished good. Because then when it gets transshipped to the United States, you have to figure out how much of the value added came from outside of the free trade area. And maybe even which countries it came from, if you had different tariff rates against different countries. So administratively, free trade areas can be incredibly complex. Customs unions turn that around just the opposite. Administratively, they're very easy. When it comes into the customs union area, a tariff is applied. Since every country has exactly the same tariff, you don't have to worry about trying to arbitrage the tariff rates from one country to another. The problem with customs union is each country is essentially giving up its own trade policy. And it's generally giving it up to some supranational or supra-country organization, the EU government, in the case of the European Union, which means the Germans and the French and the Italian and Spanish and so forth, citizens and governments don't really have any direct input into the tariff rates that affect their own industries. So politically, customs unions don't jump into being very quickly, but once they're there, they're pretty easy to rule. So with all of the press that gets taken place about free trade areas or free trade agreements, the question is, are they good or are they bad? So President Obama just came back from Asia. One of his big goals on his Asian trip was to conclude, or at least agree to conclude before the end of the year, a free trade agreement with South Korea. Didn't happen. The Bush administration, when it was still in power, negotiated a free trade agreement with Colombia, but it's never been approved by the Senate. It is a treaty between two countries, so it needs approval by the Senate. But the Senate has never voted on it. They haven't voted it up, they haven't voted it down. They just haven't voted on it. And so it's sitting there. But one of the questions we might want to ask ourselves is, even with all the proliferation of free trade agreements that they've been, are they good or are they bad? Do they increase national economic welfare or do they reduce it? Can we figure that out? And it turns out it depends upon whether these trade areas are what we refer to as trade creating or trade diverting. So trade creation is simply how much new trade is actually taking place. Trade diversion occurs when our imports are shifted from a non-member to a member country on the basis of differential tariff rates, zero for the member country, something positive for the non-member country, rather than the underlying cost of the product. So let's see if we can't illustrate this with an example. Let's suppose that the U.S. can produce wheat for $4 and France can produce wheat for $6. And let's suppose that the U.K. is importing wheat and has a tariff of $5 on wheat. Okay, so here's the import demand curve for the U.K. So this would be the export supply curve for the U.S. and would tell us that the price that the U.K. could import from for the U.S. would be $4. And if the U.K. did not have a tariff, they would import that quantity of wheat from the U.S. If the U.S. was not an available producer, and they were forced to import wheat from France, France's export supply curve would be up here. The price of wheat in France is $6. And if we had free trade, no U.S. trade, but free trade between France and the U.K., the U.K. would import that volume of or that quantity of wheat from France. But remember, we assume that the U.K. has a $5 tariff. So the tariff is going to be applied against both French wheat as well as U.S. wheat. So the tariff-ridden price will end up being $9, the $4 U.S. price, plus the $5 tariff. So this is the export supply curve for the U.S. plus the tariff. And notice that with the tariff in place, the U.K. imports only MT. So this is where we want to start our analysis and think, now, okay, we've got this situation. What happens if the UK now joins the economic union UK now joins the economic union? These are imports. Of which France is already a member. So notice that in that case, we'll move from a tariff-ridden price of $9 to a free trade price of 6. We'll import all our wheat from France and not from the U.S. So there are a couple of things that we can look at here. So let me label a couple of areas, A, B, C. So what happens then is the price of wheat falls and the quantity of imported wheat increases. So we can come back to our changes in consumer surplus . So consumer surplus has increased by A and B. We're not worried about producer surplus here, but we want to think about what happens to government revenue. Remember, we were importing from the U.S. and charging a $5 tariff. Now we're importing more from France, but we're importing it at a zero tariff rate. So there's no tariff revenue. So our tariff revenue goes down by A and C. And therefore our net, we have a gain of A of B and a loss of C. Well, notice what B represents is coming about is because we have this increase in the quantity imported. So this C area is part of what we call trade creation. B. I'm sorry, did I say C? B. B is trade creation, right? It's given us a measure of the additional trade that's taking place. The value of the additional trade that's taking place. So it's the increase in the quantity under the demand curve. But C represents trade that has been shifted from the United States, which is the low-cost producer, to France. So this is actually trade diversion. So we've increased the total volume of trade, but we're also shifting where the trade comes from. In this case, away from the United States and to France. So from England's perspective, we have both trade creation and trade diversion. Whether or not England is better off under this arrangement depends upon whether the trade creation is greater than or less than the trade diversion. Notice, I've lost all my tariff revenue. Why don't I just import it from the U.S.? I'd be much better off. Right? But because I've diverted trade from the U.S. to France, I'm actually paying a higher price. So that trade diversion doesn't allow me to, by getting rid of my tariff, doesn't allow me to capture the full benefits of having no tariff revenue. So here's a couple of cases where we can think about a situation where trade diversion dominates. Okay, so this would be mostly trade diversion. So if we thought about our three areas, A, B, C, so our B triangle is our trade creation. Our C rectangle, is our trade diversion. So in this case, it appears that trade diversion is much greater than trade creation. We can see the same thing in a similar thing where trade creation dominates. In this particular case, here's A, B, C. So in this case, we have a situation where trade creation is substantially larger than the trade diversion. So what we want to ask ourselves then is, what are the circumstances under which trade creation or trade diversion would dominate? Is there anything general that we can say about that? And the answer, of course, is yes. And so we can say the following. Trade creation dominates if the trade block partner is already the low-cost producer or nearly the low-cost producer. So if you come back to here, notice France is nearly the low-cost producer. They don't produce quite as efficiently or at a low cost as the U.S. does, but pretty close. At least pretty close relative to what we have over here. So the more the country that you're entering into a free trade agreement with is one of the most efficient producers in the world, then you're much more likely to have trade creation rather than trade diversion. The second point may not be so obvious. When there are more countries in the trade bloc, so why would that be true? Exactly. The more countries that you have in the trade bloc, the more likely it is that one of the lowest cost producers is going to be one of those members. So obviously, one easy way to think about it is expand the trade bloc to include all countries in the world. You, by definition, have the most efficient producer, and therefore you will have trade creation, which is, of course, why we like multilateral negotiations, because we've included all of those countries in the world. And then finally, it depends upon what the size of the tariffs are, especially the tariff on outside producers. So the bigger the tariffs, the more likely then that trade creation will take place than the case when tariffs are very low. So, and trade diversion, of course, is just the opposite. Okay, so what we're going to do next week, we only have one class next week, right? So what we're going to do on Tuesday and then the following Tuesday, we're still going to talk about the WTO, but we're going to talk about the WTO and some of the controversies that have come up in multinational trade or multilateral trade negotiations, things like labor standards. Is the WTO really a world government? We'll talk about environmental standards and international trade. So that's kind of where we'll be going over the next couple of lectures. Have a good weekend, and keep the axe.